We acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their cultures and to elders both past, present and emerging. Murder in the Land of Oz. I'm Jess.
I'm Ellen. We've done it twice now.
Ellen realized last time that nobody knew who we were. So we say our names now. We're recording this in the past. So how's coronavirus looking in this 2 weeks from now?
Are we out yet? Please say we're out.
I don't think so. Someone was saying that we're not going to be able to travel overseas until 2023.
Yeah, I read that also. That kind Zane of puts our plans to go to Dollywood at the end of next year Dollywood. Kind of on hold. Will you guys become Patreon so you can crowdfund our trip to Dollywood?
Oh my God, no, don't say that, because otherwise they'll just be like, they advertise for Patreon money so they can go to Dollywood.
Well, you know.
Potato, potato. I used my Patreon money this month to research this Scott Johnson episode. Mm-mm. And a book. I bought a book for a case that I want to do.
Ooh, love that.
Ooh.
I didn't even get to say tearful goodbye to my Patreon money before it flew out of my account to pay for all the ridiculous shit I've had to pay for since. Don't have to move house during the coronavirus pandemic is my advice to you. Don't lose your job and also have to move at the same time. They are not two things that are good to happen. At once.
Not at the same time.
Not at the same time. I really want to mention before we get into the episode that Zane has a new cat. We didn't actually talk about it.
Oh my God. Does Zane have a new cat or what? Her name is Leia.
As in princess.
And she's fucking fab. And Fifi is jealous as shit when I touch Leia. And then Leia's jealous as shit when I touch Fifi. So I'm in heaven.
The cat nonsense is going to increase by 100%.
But they don't like it. Fifi still doesn't like it when I pick her up.
No.
And Leia's not a huge fan of it yet. Because I feel like Fifi has been telling her shit about me.
Oh, yeah. Fifi's like, look, everybody who comes to Zane's house is great. Except this one girl, the red bob, who is cray cray.
Fifi is currently sitting on a box. Not a box. On a paper bag.
Mm.
With her ears back. Fifi! She looked at me as I called her name. Leia, I think, is at the food bowl.
A great place to be.
So that's your update. I'm in heaven. Okay, we didn't check in last episode. Let's check in. How are you going?
Oh God. How am I going? I don't know. A six?
Yeah. How are you going, Zane? He's a five. Holy shit.
That's pretty high for Zane.
I don't know. It's been a weird... I had therapy on Friday and boy, oh boy, was that the most confronting shit ever.
Therapist David always drags us down the street by the hair.
Therapist David was... Okay, I haven't seen my therapist since February the 26th. Yes. February the 24th. We've spoken on the phone since then, but we haven't had a full session.
Right.
And boy, oh boy, did that man absolutely... Well, basically, I've had this ongoing situation for a couple of months, and it's just absolutely ripped my life apart. And therapist David's not a fan of the whole situation and how I'm sad all the time. So we had quite a chat. He's lovely. Like, I should preface this. He is an amazing, incredible man who makes me feel a lot better about myself and makes me feel a bit less insane about feeling sad all the time. Because he's like, you know what? People haven't been very nice to you. And I'm like,
he's also probably like, everybody I talk to is pretty sad. So...
So yeah, it's just, I mean, I was having a chat to my friend Laura today, who's actually a mental health nurse, and she was like, Jess, like, you're putting in the hard work now, which is good.
Yeah.
So yeah, it just, this whole self-realization and trying to move past the self-loathing stage at the moment, because I just hate myself. So trying to move through that is tricky during a pandemic. The isolation is starting to get to me. Mm. Working from home is also really difficult. But yeah, rock on. I'm alive. It's my birthday soon.
In like a month.
Shut up. I don't have anything else to look forward to.
Okay, fair enough. Neither do I.
Shit. But yeah, trying to read. Been reading a lot of confronting things. Who's watched Normal People? Who's watched that shit? And who's also read Conversations with Friends, which is by the same author, Sally Rooney? Because that book fucking came for me. And Normal People came for me too. And also I'm hating how everybody's talking about it. They're like, oh, first love. It's so amazing. I don't want a love like that. I don't want a love with a guy that has sex with me and asks me to keep it secret. It's fucked.
I don't know what you're talking about. I digress. I haven't seen it or read it and I never will.
Okay, great. It's Ellen's turn.
We're talking about Moira.
Moira. What case are you doing this week?
I am doing two cases actually that I've jammed into one because they're related. Oh, of course it's not one of my crazy ones. It's a shorter one for me. The caveat for me is very strong there. So these are two cases that I had bookmarked. I had a little bit of an idea when we did our missing persons episode, which kind of like formed the basis for the way that we feel like the show's going to go in the future, where we like would do like a whole like season in quotation marks on like missing persons or blah, blah, blah. So I had a few of those cases bookmarked for a future if that ever happened. And then we also had a message from a listener named Tyler about these two cases who was like, hey, I heard you're living in Tasmania at the moment. Like, here are these couple of cases, like blah, blah, blah. And they actually happened. So I'm staying with my parents at the moment during the Rona. I'm not going to say what town because I realized that was a mistake. because there's not that many people there, so it'd be pretty easy to work it out. but these cases happened like literally 20 minutes like in like the next town over, obviously long before I got here, so you know it's all fine. But yeah, it's very interesting, like, you know, we've talked about cases like in Brisbane and stuff like that we're pretty familiar with, but it's very strange like being in like a very small town and reading about cases that happened like the next small town over, which is identical to yours, and just being like that doesn't make me,
because it's like, it's sort of hard. It's sort of easy for, like, you know, to sort of contemplate homicide in places like Brisbane or Sydney or Melbourne, because they're huge, you know, so many people.
Uh-huh.
But like a small town, like that's so eerie.
It's fucked. So yes, thank you to Tyler for messaging us about this case, and specifically me, because I was the one you were talking to. And yeah, honestly, researching, I already like knew a little bit about both of these cases because, as I said, they'd come up, but I hadn't done a deep dive. And then reading about it, I was like, cool, well, I can never leave my house ever again because they're both unsolved. So homeboy's still out there. Anyway, let's dive into it. So our first case, Nancy Grundwalt was born in Flensburg, Germany on the 5th of February 1967, and she was age 26 at the time of her disappearance. So she had worked as a travel agent for a few years, and she was a very well-traveled person. She had been to 14 countries, and she spoke fluent German, French, and English.
Jesus Christ.
Excessive. All these Europeans, they all speak 50 billion languages. Like, anyway, so she had first traveled to Australia in 1991. She returned home to Germany for a little while and then set off on another trip, this time to New Zealand in July of 1992. So she lived in New Zealand for just under a year while she was attending the Cap'n Ray Bible College in Auckland. She completed her course, and her parents came to visit her in New Zealand between the 3rd of February, is how you say that word, and the 2nd of March. And after her parents left, Nancy set up for another 3 or so months traveling around Australia. And she'd met quite a few people, like, in her travels and in her life and stuff like that. So she was going to go and, like, see a bit of Australia, visit people, you know, travel around mostly by bike and just see the country a bit before she started off on whatever would come up in her life next. So she left Auckland on the 6th of March 1993. She flew first to Melbourne and then jumped on a flight from Melbourne to Devonport, where she arrived around 4:40 in the afternoon. This, researching this case, gave me the incredible information that the town of Devonport has an airport, which I did not know about.
Neither.
No, well, you wouldn't. It's just not the kind of thing you know about Devonport. There's definitely a port there. That's where you get off the Spirit of Tasmania, but you can also fly there, apparently. Just one of the many incredible things about Devonport. So, while in the amazing town of Devonport, Nancy stayed at the YHA Youth Hostel. She stayed there for 3 days, And while she was in town, she attended the Devonport Baptist Church. She went to the Taz Travel Center and paid a deposit for a one-way ticket on the Abel Tasman, which is the ferry that, which used to be the ferry that takes you from the Bass Strait back to the mainland, which is now the Spirit of Tasmania. And she booked that for the 4th of April. So she was planning about a month's stay in Tasmania. She then went to the Westpac Bank and converted her New Zealand money into Australian dollars, which she then deposited into a new bank account. And since she was planning on being in Hobart the next week to visit a friend, she arranged to have her new card and her PIN number sent on to the Hobart branch, and she would go and pick it up down there. On the 9th of March, Nancy hired a red Road Chief Marauder mountain bike from a bike hire service. She paid for 2 weeks usage, saying that she would return it on the 22nd of March. And she left her backpack there with the guy who owned the bike hire place, Trevor Goss, saying that she wouldn't be able to carry it with her on her bike. And Trevor was like, yeah, no worries, I'll hold on to it for you. There's no indication of what Nancy did with the rest of her day on the 9th of March, but it's assumed she rode into Launceston, a journey that would have taken roughly 5 hours from Devonport. She checked I don't understand cycling as an activity.
I can't ride a bike.
What? You can't ride a bike?
No, I've never learned. My parents never taught me.
Oh, that's really sad. Catherine and John, get it together.
God, there's sadder things about me, isn't there, though?
I mean, yes, but that's a little bit sad. I can ride a bike. I just choose not to for moral reasons. So she checked into the Backpackers Hostel on George Street on the 10th of March. On the 11th of March at 10:40 a.m., she took out $200 from her bank account, and then it is believed that she took a Red Line coach from Launceston to St. Helens, which is on the east coast. So she travelled. Thing about Tasmania is that it's mad small, so you can kind of go like from the northwest to the east coast pretty easily by bike in like a day or so. It makes it seem like she travelled like some vast distance, but really it's only a couple hundred kilometres. So on the morning of Friday the 12th of March... I accidentally skipped a sentence. So when she got to St. Helens, she stayed at the St. Helens Hostel on the night of the 11th of March. So on the morning of Friday the 12th of March, Nancy set off from her hostel on her bike and headed south down the Tasman Highway down towards Beaumaris. She got off her bike and went for a walk on Beaumaris Beach, then purchased a soft drink from the Surfside Motel before getting back on her bike and riding down the highway. She was seen by Christine Ladig and Tanya DeGreeve, who were also staying at the St. Helens Hostel and had spoken to Nancy the night before. And I believe they were driving, like, on the opposite side of the highway, and they kind of, like, noticed her. And then, like, as they passed, they were like, oh, that was Nancy. Like, wonder where she's going kind of thing.
Mm.
That was around 11 a.m., and that would be the last sighting of Nancy Grunwald. So she never went to drop off the bike and pick up her backpack from Trevor Goss, and she never got on the Abel Tasman headed to Melbourne. But it would be several weeks before Nancy would be reported missing by Reverend Ivor Jones, who lived in South Australia and who Nancy had arranged to visit during her trip. She didn't have the most nailed down schedule. So, you know, it was very much just kind of like a vibes sort of thing. Like she was going to visit friends and kind of, you know, even to Trevor, the bike guy, she was like, if I have a little bit longer, like, is that going to be a drama or whatever? Because she didn't have like a planned out itinerary. So it was like a couple of weeks before anybody was like expecting to see her or, you know. Mm. So he phoned the Victoria Police, and it wouldn't be until the 19th of April that the Tasmanian police were actually informed about this disappearance. And the investigation was initially centered on Devonport, until eventually they had found out that she had indeed been in the East Coast area. And then that's when the investigation kind of moved their focus over there. So extensive searches of the area were conducted. I'm going to now describe the area, which I didn't have to Google anything about, which is nice. So how, like, the highway that she was on, like, we've talked a lot about, like, backpackers going missing and stuff on these, like, big highways between, you know, Sydney and Melbourne and stuff like that.
Oh, I've just looked at a photo of her. Oh.
I know. She's actually very charming looking. Very similar glasses to you.
Oh, the sweet angel. Oh, the poor thing.
I know. So, yeah, the Tasman Highway, this is not, like, a big interstate highway. It's literally, like, a two-lane highway. And it in some parts, it's literally right next to the coastline. Like, you look to your left and there's just the beach. And then in some parts, it goes fairly inland. So the route Nancy would have taken, she would have left from St. Helens. She would have gone through Beaumaris and then through to Scamander, which is a journey that takes about 20 minutes by car and an hour by bike. And this is the part of the highway that is, like, right next to the coast. So, like, on the eastern side, it's literally just the ocean. And then on the west, it's either, like, coastal bushland or, like, little people's holiday shacks and stuff like that. So it's not a big, busy highway like, you know, the Hume Highway or any other place that we've talked about. But it's also not, like, the back roads. You know what I mean? Like, it's the only road in and out of the area. People use it all the time. Like, I don't know what it was like in March in 1993, but, you know, it's still, even though it's, like, a rural road, it's a fairly high traffic rural road. There we go. That's a good phrase to describe it. So the police initially searched the entire area from St. Helens to Swansea, which is still on the Tasman Highway, about 100 kilometers south down by Freycinet National Park. They conducted aerial searches over St. Helens and Bishnoe, land searches around St. Mary's and Fingal, and they also searched the Breakaday River. They then conducted a search along the roadside of the highway, 50 metres either side of the highway, like on the nature strips and everything like that, from St. Helens to Bishnoe, as well as searching all the resorts, picnic grounds and walking tracks in the area, and also the like, northern section of Douglas Apsley National Park. So Nancy's disappearance had made the news, and police had made an appeal for eyewitnesses, but I think it was kind of a problem similar to, like, we talked about in our missing persons episode. Do you remember there was the guy who was the backpacker who went missing in the Northern Territory, and they were like, be on the lookout for a backpacker who is tanned with dreadlocks from New Zealand. And we were like, cool, that only describes 8 million people.
Vague.
So they had said, like, be on the lookout for a backpacker riding a bike, you know. And so they got tips from around the area, but also tips from, like, Cradle Mountain, which is in the northwest. So they did have to do some searches kind of outside of the area to follow up on these tips. That
you've been there.
I have been there.
I recognize that name.
It was nice. It was a good trip. Can recommend. So the fact that almost six weeks had passed since Nancy's disappearance meant that even people that had seen Nancy and spoken to her, like, no longer really had the strongest memory of it. You know, she didn't really know anybody in Tasmania. She did have one friend in Hobart who she was meant to go and visit, but, like, it's not like she was making lasting friends at the St. Helens Hostel. So people had chatted to her and she'd mentioned that she was going on a bike ride, but they just didn't remember, you know, what
details,
she said.
Yeah.
Didn't remember
it had
details.
Been a long time.
Yeah. Obviously, the police had contacted Nancy's parents also. They gave the police some information about Nancy. Like, they said that she was an avid photographer and loved swimming in coastal areas, and that she had done some bushwalking in the past, but she wasn't likely to go bushwalking by herself. So, you know, it's not likely to have been, like, a lost in the woods kind of scenario.
Mm.
They also said that they had a really good relationship with Nancy, and she phoned them about once a week. The last time they spoke was actually the afternoon before the day that she disappeared, and it was not usual for her to not be in contact. So ultimately, the police would take over 280 statements, file 500 reports, and offer a reward of $30,000 for information about Nancy's disappearance. So her parents came down to Tasmania to plead for their daughter's safe return, and, you know, it was big news. It was, you know, very much front page news. What's happened?
Nothing.
Okay. Jess is pulling a suspicious face.
Shane's just giving me shit.
Okay, fair enough. but yeah, so after this first initial, like, investigation and big, like, news media hype and stuff like that, the already pretty chilly trail went cold. You know, there were no real eyewitnesses, and apart from, you know, they interviewed the local, like, scumbags and stuff, but there weren't really.
Oh, God! Like, oh, I can picture them casting the local scumbags in my mind of, like, the story of Nancy. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I can see it. It's very visceral.
It's very easy to imagine. So, yeah, there were no real suspects. And so Nancy's case kind of dropped out of public knowledge for about 2 years when another tourist, Victoria Cafasso, who was 20 years old and from Italy, was found murdered on Beaumaris Beach in October of 1995. So Victoria was born, she was born in England, and she was a dual Italian and English citizen. And she, like Nancy, was very well traveled, which, again, super easy in Europe when you can just, like, you know.
You can hop on a boat.
You can just like walk down the street and you're like, oh, whoops, I took a wrong turn and now I'm in Belgium. Like, it's a bit harder when, you know, you're in a big old country.
It's a bit harder when we're in like a fucking island in the middle of nowhere.
I know. Even harder when you're on a smaller island next to the bigger island in the middle of nowhere.
Trying to explain to people, like, I know you went to England to study, so you've been to places in Europe and stuff like that. But explaining to people that I've never been to Europe, and the look on people's faces, they're like,
because it is such a cliche.
And I'm like, it's far away. It's so fucking expensive.
I know, but it's such a cliche for people our age who have, like, quote, done Europe. Like, everybody's like, oh, have you not gone, like, backpacking around Europe? I didn't even go backpacking around Europe. I went to France and I went to the Tintin Museum in Belgium.
You went to Iceland, though, didn't you?
No, I went to Sweden.
Sweden, right.
It was very cool, literally and, like, vibe-wise. So, Victoria also spoke fluent Italian, English, and French, and she had previously worked as a tour guide. And she had been studying law in Italy, but she chose to defer that course in July of 1995, and she went to stay with her grandparents in England for a bit to kind of think about her future. So she enrolled in a language course at Portsmouth University, which was due to start in August of 1996, and decided that she'd go kind of like on a big blowout trip to Australia. So she contacted her cousin Simon De Salis, and who she'd actually only met twice previously, and arranged to stay with him, and got on a flight to Tasmania from England via Hong Kong. She arrived in Launceston on the 6th of October 1995. I can't imagine being like, I'm going to go on this amazing trip to Tasmania. I'm going to Australia, land down
That's
under.
That's literally what I was thinking, but I didn't want to say it in case you were like, you fucking bitch, Tasmania's amazing.
Tasmania is amazing. I love Tasmania. Like, I think every day, like, look out the window, I'm like, wow, what a beautiful place to live. We're so blessed. Like, Launceston's a shithole. I've spent a lot of time in Launceston, like, and I'm not a fan.
You're off the like, you've gone this flight from London to Hong Kong, yeah, and then Hong Kong to Launceston.
So you're a well-traveled Italian tour guide, and you get
you'd
off the plane,
like, what
at Launceston.
The fuck have I done?
Anyway, I'm sure so there are sorry, good things Victoria. About Launceston. Oh my God. Cataract Gorge is really nice. You guys should go there. Anyway, so she arrived in Launceston on the 6th of October 1995. And she was picked up by her cousin Simon and a friend of his named Peter. And they travelled to Simon's house in Beaumaris. So, as I said before, Beaumaris is in, like, the middle of St. Helens and Scamander. And it's, like, it's literally, it's barely a town. There is, like, 50, like, holiday shacks there, and, like, 8 people live there full-time, and the only business that is there is the Surfside Motel. Like, it's an extremely small place. So there's not much to do, and there's not too many people to come in contact with, and while she did meet a few of Simon's friends while she was there, and they, like, went to a birthday party, and she hung out with a few people, she didn't really spend any time with anybody or associate with too many people there. So on the morning of the 11th of October, Victoria told Simon that she's going for a walk and asked if she could borrow a small carry bag to put her things in. She left the house at about 9 a.m. and walked in the direction of the beach. So a few people saw Victoria on the morning, but the descriptions of what she was wearing were pretty inconsistent throughout. So it's kind of established now that she was wearing, like, a blue t-shirt that had a wolf print on it, and then some kind of brown, I read brown, and then I also read green or grey pants. As she had on a blue and white floral bikini and white sand shoes. And in her carry bag, she had a beach towel, a bottle of water, a Walkman, sunglasses, sunscreen, and her purse with about $500 Australian and some other foreign currency in it. So she walked down from the cottage where she was staying, down the footpath, next to the Surfside Hotel, which was the same hotel that Nancy Grunwald stopped at to get a drink while she was on her little bike ride, and then crossed the Tasman Highway to get to the beach. She was seen between 9:55 a.m. and 10:10 a.m. sunbaking on the sand by an Iris Smith. At 1:30 p.m. that afternoon, a woman named Margaret McIntyre was walking her dog along the beach when she discovered Victoria's body lying on the waterline of the beach with the waves washing over her. Margaret washed to a nearby house where she spoke with Russell Harwood and Jeffrey Adams, and they went with Margaret back to the beach and confirmed that, like, it was indeed a body. And then Margaret and Russell went and get the police while Jeffrey Adams waited on the scene and watched over the body. A few minutes later, Senior Constable Petter and Constable Ferguson arrived on the scene. So Victoria was almost entirely naked with just her bikini top still on her body but pulled up over her breasts. She had been stabbed, lacerated, and bludgeoned on her face and head, which had resulted in, quote, horrific and extensive wounds. She'd also been stabbed in her back and chest.
That is fucking violent. That is overkill. That's fucked.
It's truly horrific. Like, I instantly feel terrible for joking about the whole Launceston thing because what happened to her was so, like...
That is vile. Oh, my God. And, I mean, every murder we talk about is disgusting.
Yeah, but this is really, like, just beyond. Depraved. Depraved is the word that comes to mind. So the first actions were for the police to establish roadblocks, go door knocking, and search the immediate area. And there was a bit of a question about... So there was a... So these three initial cops arrived on the scene and they kind of like did their best to kind of keep things under control, I suppose, before backup could arrive, which I believe is coming from the Launceston CIB or possibly from St. Helens. But there were a few things that like weren't done 100% correctly. I'll phrase it like that. So, you know, there were things like some of the officers like saw footprints in the sand. But there was like a bit of confusion. Like one officer was like, yep, we definitely saw these footprints in the sand in this location. And then other officers were like, no, we didn't actually see anything. They also moved the body at some point. So the body had been moved. So one set of the crime scene photos, this all came out later in the inquest, but one set of the crime scene photos, like her body was on the water's edge and like the water was like lapping at her body. And then the next set of photos showed her pulled out of the water, but the tide at the time was rising, not falling. So it was evident that she had been moved up the beach, like by a person. And then it later came out that they had decided to move the body because they were worried about evidence getting washed away by the tide before the backup police, you know, came in. They also used a tarp from Russell Harwood's house to cover the body with.
No.
Yeah, which is kind of
like... No.
It's not what you're meant to do.
From a civilian's house?
Yeah.
No.
Not, yeah. Not the
best. That's not good.
I don't think that's in the police handbook.
No.
So during the initial search of the area, there was a section of disturbed sand that was located... that the initial officers kind of dubbed the crime scene, which was about 50 meters away from where Victoria's body was found. Here there was a collection of footprints, one set that one officer pretty confidently referred to as female footprints, although I'm not 100% sure how you can tell, as well as another collection of items that were later believed to be Victoria's, including a bangle, sunglasses, a shoulder bag, sand shoes, a ring, and a watch. These items were spread in all directions in a circumference 8.5 meters around the disturbed sand. Other items like her clothing, her bikini bottoms, and a shell necklace she had been wearing would never be found. A time of death couldn't be properly established by looking at the body as her body had been in the water. So instead they used a little bit of, you know, coastal geomorphology knowledge to work out the likely window. So they said that the disturbed area of sand... The disturbance of the area of sand was likely created at the time of the high tide, as it was in moist sand and the bottom part of it had been washed out. So they had concluded that the crime had happened when the water level was at that point and beginning to recede, which gave them a range between 11:30 a.m. and 12:35 p.m. I think I mentioned this later on in the episode, but just in case I didn't, they later found out, like, after they, like, questioned people and, you know, looked around the town and everything like that, they later determined that between the time of 8:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m, 50 people had been on Beaumaris Beach. So, like, this incredibly broad window of time, 11:30 to 12:35, you know, an hour, basically. A beach that is, I think it's, like, 4 kilometers long. It's not the biggest beach in the world. And, like, she was stabbed, like, 20 times to her face. Like, I don't understand how nobody saw anything or heard anything. 50 people were on the beach that day. Like, huh? Anyway, the following day, an autopsy was undertaken at the Royal Hobart Hospital. The cause of death was, quote, exsanguination due to multiple stab wounds, including wounds to the right atrium. So, essentially, she bled to death. It was found that she had sustained 21 stab wounds to the body, all on her right side except for one, and all in the shoulder, neck, chest, and neck area. She had sustained a number of slashes or lacerations to her head, neck, arms, legs, and torso, as well as abrasions and bruising. She had a bruise on her right wrist, which had been possibly caused by the bangle she had been wearing, and abrasions on her left wrist, which were caused by her watch. She was missing 3 teeth from her upper jaw. She had fractures to her jaw and to the bridge of her nose caused by blunt force injury, as well as blunt force injury to the bones in her right hand. Because her body, her lower body in particular, had been in the water, there was no real evidence of sexual assault or any kind of penetration. But that was because she was in the water. Like, you know, it doesn't confirm or refute anything. No. So the pathologist, Dr. Lyons, concluded that the stab wounds were likely caused by a knife, that there was a second weapon also used, which was likely a heavy, straight-edged object, and that the injuries to her forearm and hands were consistent with defensive wounds. So Victoria's parents, I'm going to pronounce her mum's name wrong, I'm very sorry, Xenia? I'm going to go with Xenia, that sounds nicer, and Giuseppe, as well as her grandmother, came to Tasmania from Italy and England. And they visited Beaumaris Beach, and Xenia took a handful of sand to take back with her to Italy. When they arrived back to Italy after, you know, coming to visit to Tasmania, they had actually received a letter from Victoria, which was sent 2 days before her death, that said that she was having a great time. A memorial service was held for Victoria in England near her grandparents' place on the 24th of November. The next day, her father Giuseppe died of a heart attack.
No! Oh, no.
The mum. Oh, can you imagine being the mum? Just the worst time in your entire life. I don't know how she ever recovered. So the Launceston CIB set up shop in the St. Helens Police Station to investigate the murder. And the investigation was pretty extensive. So obviously they did all the usual stuff. They searched the area. They did, you know, land searches and sea searches or marine searches. They interviewed everybody that Victoria had met during her short time in Tasmania. They got alibis from the locals, etc., etc. The police also held, like, a town hall meeting at the Surfside Motel in order to kind of, like, squeeze the town folks a little bit and see if anybody who came up with any information...
Make them sweat.
Make them sweat, exactly. One of the leads of the investigation later said that he went in there assuming that every person could be a suspect. Like, it was all very, like... It was very Midsummer Murders. Like, it was very much, like, small town.
See, that is the vibe I'm getting. Mm. Also, Midsummer Murders, it's a very small place.
They would have had a murder rate, like, triple New York, I reckon. One person died there every single week. Like, suspicious. Why were, like, did the UK have federal police? What's the UK FBI? Where were they?
They're like, fuck, there's something in Midsummer. We need to fix it.
They're like looking at their crime statistics for the year and they're like, yeah, London, you know, 8 murders a week. Like, oh, that's terrible. Midsummer, 26. What is going on in Midsummer?
Poor Victoria.
Yes, let's keep on talking about that. So Interpol was also involved in the investigation.
That's the UK FBI.
Well, Interpol is like the world FBI.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure the inter is for international and the pol is police.
Zane, who's the UK FBI? MI5.
MI5, classic.
I just said that Interpol was the UK FBI.
No, Interpol is like the world police. So they contacted Interpol to see if there was any connection between Victoria's death and her grandfather, who had been the chief of police in Rome. So they were like... Mafia question mark, but nothing came up there. A profile was created.
Is there a mafia in Hobart in Tasmania?
I don't know. I really don't. I don't think so. A profile was generated by Detective Inspector, wait for it, Killmeyer.
Oh, that's pointed.
Of the Australian Violent Crime Analysis Centre, of the possible killer. So Killmeyer believed that the perpetrator was likely a family man with an unpredictable violent temper who was probably being protected by his family. So there would end up being three additional investigations into Victoria's murder. So a review of the first investigation occurred in February of 1996, with it being found that there were 35 additional aspects to the investigation that required further attention. A second task force would investigate persons of interest, and that investigation was conducted from March of 1996 to March of 1998. And in September of 1998, another review was undertaken with the purpose of consolidating evidence and information and making a decision about the future of the investigation. I get the big old vibe that they just had like a million leads going in a million directions, none of them particularly juicy, and they just wound up with a whole lot of files about like some guy who had blown through on a bike 3 weeks earlier who gave somebody the side eye once, you know, because there was no real solid leads. In 2003, Coroner Don Jones began a coronial inquest and he began with an appeal for information from the community for any information that might assist him in reaching a finding. When the inquest began, Don Jones started hearing witness testimony and, you know, started like getting into it, and it became evident that the volume of evidence was so great that it would need another review. So the inquest was adjourned. Detective Inspector Little conducted a review of the evidence. He re-examined all of the forensic evidence, like literally every single piece of evidence, re-interviewed witnesses, redid a whole lot of the forensic testing and stuff like that. They did all this like extremely intense like 3D mapping of the area using like all the photographs and stuff like that to kind of get like one big case file with all the correct relevant information in it to use for the rest of the inquest. So that is like a couple of sentences to brush over what was like an extremely difficult piece of work and investigation and stuff like that, but like we gotta sail along. So the inquest resumed in April of 2004, and Coroner Don Jones had a fair amount of critiques to deliver about the police investigation, including that the crime scene had been contaminated when the police used Russell Harwood's tarp to cover up the body. That of the hundreds of footprints seen in the sand that day by all the various police officers who had trampled all over the site, only one cast of one footprint had been taken.
What?
They only took one cast. So they had all of these footprints, right? They took like five photos and took one cast of a footprint. And that the police had failed to cordon off the entire beach.
Jesus.
Yeah. So the coroner would eventually find that Victoria had died at Beaumaris Beach between 10:10 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, October 11th, 1995, that she had been involved in a violent struggle prior to her death, during which she had attempted to defend herself. He determined that the persons responsible for her death was physically powerful, that the blunt object was used on Victoria while she was still defending herself, the knife had been used after she had been subdued, that the cause of death was caused by two fatal stab wounds to the right side of her chest, penetrating the heart, that her body was left in the water after the death, and that the body was moved by the current down the beach. So there's this whole argy-bargy that I didn't include about whether or not... Victoria was 178 centimeters, I believe, and she weighed 83 kilos. So she was not, like, a tiny little fragile girl, you know what I mean? She was pretty solid. And there was... Because, you know, she was 50 meters away from where that disturbed area was, they were like, well, did the killer drag her from where she was down to the beach? Like, did he drag her or did he pick her up and carry her and, like, put her in the waterline or something like that? And they were like, it would be probably difficult for somebody to do that, like one person to be able to move her and everything like that. And then they ultimately found that it was likely that it was the water, like the current moved her down the beach rather than a person. So after Victoria's murder, there was, you know, a lot of media and local chatter about whether or not it was connected to Nancy's disappearance. But Detective Inspector Graham Hickey, who had been in charge of both investigations, was dismissive of a connection, saying that the only link is that they were women, young, foreign, and alone. Hickey said that there was a much stronger connection between Victoria and a local girl, Hilda Jackson, who was one of the few people that Victoria had met during her visit. So as I literally just said, Victoria was tall. She was 178 centimeters, weighed about 83 kilos and had blonde hair. Hilda was of a similar build, 176 centimeters and also blonde. And a few witnesses who had seen Victoria on the beach had actually thought that it was Hilda. Like, these two girls apparently looked extremely alike. And this information was a little bit unclear, but it was also... I read in a couple of sources that Victoria had actually gone to Hilda Jackson's house on the day of the murders as well. So basically, yeah, there was a theory that it was a case of mistaken identity. Somebody had it out for Hilda and accidentally got Victoria instead. So 2 weeks before Victoria's murder, Hilda had been stopped by a man on the beach who asked her where the nearest pathway out of the beach was. Hilda had said that she had an uneasy feeling. She went for a swim and noticed that the man kept on looking at her. And then he eventually left. Hilda returned home to her home, which was right next to the beach. and she'd left a side door open. So she like came into her house back in through this open side door and came into her room, and she had left out like underwear and clothes to change back into when she came back from the beach, and her underwear was missing. So there were quite a few persons of interest in the case. One, you know, as I said, they interviewed all the local scumbags and, you know, couldn't really nail anybody down. But one person of interest that was not actually brought to the coroner's attention was a man named Dr. Roman Hassel, who was a gynecologist living in St. Helens at the time. He was brought to the attention of police because a person saw him at a service station either the day of or the day after the murder with scratches all over his face. And he told police that he got them from falling down while drunk.
Yeah, sounds about right, Jared.
Basil. Wait, what was his name? Roman. Oh,
I was making
Oh, you're making a Jared Baden Clay joke. Yep. Nobody ever gets scratches on their faces from something other than being scratched. So he told police that he got them, from falling down while drunk. And he said that he was at home at the time of the murder, but he didn't have a solid alibi. So Dr. Hassel left St. Helens soon after. He began working at Royal Hobart Hospital, and then he was fired for drinking on the job and failing to disclose that he had been imprisoned in Singapore for threatening his wife with a carving knife.
I'm sorry.
Yep, so then after that cool, like, Jayant Patel thing happened where he was just, like, passed around to various regional hospitals where he would get, like, fired and then moved on but then, like, not imprisoned for whatever reason. He eventually moved to New Zealand, where it was found that he incorrectly performed a series of sterilizations.
No! Yeah. No!
He incompletely sterilized people, and then they fell pregnant. So that's not great.
Oh my god, no!
He then went back to New South Wales, where he was finally suspended and then found to be not competent to practice medicine.
Thank Jesus! Holy shit! Could you imagine?
Yes, like, literally. And so,
I'm sterilized. Oh my gosh. Oh, what? Like, I'm pregnant. What the fuck are you talking
about?
You're
like, I don't have a uterus. Oh, wait. Yes, I do. So the case Victoria's case is still open. And, the current person in charge, Detective Inspector King, has said that, like, Hassel is just one of a number of people, of persons of interest who have been interviewed. They spoke to hundreds of people. Like, there were hundreds of persons of interest. So just because this guy was a person of interest doesn't mean that he's like suspect number one.
No, he's not the only one.
Yeah, exactly. So in 2015, police released that they were looking into a previous suspect after questions arose about the validity of their 1995 alibi, but obviously nothing ever came of that because they didn't find any news articles about it. And as I mentioned, Victoria's case is still open. There is a $100,000 reward for information. And if you know anything about it, you should call Crime Stoppers.
Please call Crime Stoppers.
So in 2003, back in time now, about 6 months after the conclusion of the inquest into Victoria's death, an inquest into Nancy's death was conducted. So Coroner Peter Wilson determined that the two crimes were unlikely to be connected, and that Nancy Grunwald was indeed deceased, that she had died on or about the 12th of March 1993, that she died somewhere between St. Helens and Bishnoe, and that, quote, foul play is involved in her disappearance in the form of homicide. In 2011, retired police officer Bob Coad, who was part of the investigation into Nancy's death, stated that he believed that she was not murdered, but she was actually killed by a motorist. So a few months into the investigation, a Hobart solicitor contacted police saying that shortly after Nancy's disappearance, he'd received a message on his phone from a man who was very upset, who said that he'd been involved in, quote, a terrible accident on the East Coast and had hit a cyclist and needed help. The solicitor didn't come to the police immediately. He looked into newspapers for reports of any crashes and couldn't find any. And the person who called him never called back and couldn't be contacted, so he didn't think anything more of it until the news of Nancy's disappearance actually broke. The police investigated, but by then the message had been taped over and there were no leads to this person's identity. And so it kind of went nowhere. So this Bob Coad guy is pretty adamant. He's like, no, she was hit by a cyclist, and he's kept up with that thread, including in 2019. He came out again and said that the police should offer indemnity to anybody willing to come forward about Nancy's disappearance, which basically means that they won't prosecute or charge somebody.
But just finding out where she is and what happened.
Exactly. But the Tasmanian police were like, we can't do that because you can't offer indemnity
for murder.
Yeah, exactly. So that probably won't happen. So Nancy's case is also still open. There is a reward of $30,000 for information. And if you have any, again, contact Crime Stoppers.
Contact Crime Stoppers.
I don't think that she could have been hit by a car because, like, they very much searched pretty extensively on the sides of the road. If she got hit by a car, like, she must have, it must not have been in the area where they searched because there is a lot of bushland and stuff like that, but I just feel like you'd find, if not the body, then the bicycle. Like, it would turn up at some point.
Yeah.
Unless it was very much, like, if she had gotten further down the highway than anybody expected. But, like, they searched all the way down to Swansea, which is, like, hundreds of kilometres away.
Doesn't sound very likely. It doesn't sound very likely. If she was hit, she would be in the immediate, like, bushlands.
Yeah.
Like, a motorist isn't going to spend time.
Not necessarily. That's what I thought. I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know why anybody would murder her. And I also, yeah, I don't know if I believe that the two cases are connected, but they are pretty similar.
Very, like, quite spookily similar.
For two people to die in a very small area in two very small towns a short time apart, it raises some eyebrows. It is pretty questionable, I think. But that was it. That was the cases.
Great job! Thank you. So close to you. Please don't go outside.
I know, it's so scary. There are a few things that I didn't include in the episode because I was like, if I say this and that person is still living in the area, they might find me. So if anybody's like, why didn't she talk about that suspect? It's because I value my life.
Yes. And I value hers too. Amazing job, as Thank always. You knock it out of the park every time. Something I forgot to mention on the last episode, if you would like to become a Patreon... We do have Patreon available.
We have that option. I mentioned it because I wanted money.
So we have Patreon-only content. We're about to record an episode that's going up where we're going to do the Cliff's Notes version of BTK. So if you want to hear us talk about that, Dennis Rader, and how cooked he was, head on down to the Patreon. We obviously understand that money is tight for everybody at the moment, so No pressure. It's all good.
No pressure.
So as we've said, we've got – how many more episodes do we have to do? South Australia, Victoria, Northern Territory?
We've done the Northern Territory.
We've done the Northern Territory.
We've got to do South Australia, Queensland.
Oh, yes, you did.
Victoria. Three.
We have three more to go. And then we will be starting our new format of Mitlu. If you have any cases that you would like us to look at, either for the states coming up or for our next season, please email us at murderintheLandOfOz@gmail.com or get in contact with us on Instagram, making sure that you're leaving us reviews on the Apple podcast app. 5 stars would be great. And yeah, get in contact. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you guys so much for listening. We hope you're all staying safe. Obviously restrictions are being let up in some parts of Australia. Probably not for the rest of the world. Don't really know. But hoping that you guys are all staying safe, being really, really mindful of the people around you. It's not just about us at the moment. It's about everybody. So hope you're all staying safe and being good and rocking on, you know?
Rock on.
Cute. All right, rock on, dolls. Bye.
Hello there. Do you take great pleasure out of using large and obscure words that nobody understands? Perhaps you enjoy peppering a strange adjective into a work email, or finding a new verb to pursue as a hobby? Or perhaps you are a seasoned logophile, such as myself. An assemblage of grandiose and bombastic grandiloquence brings together all the world's most interesting, bizarre, and fascinating language to teach you a new word every day. We are available on all of your podcatchers, and you can find out more about us at thatsnotcanon.com. I cannot wait to explore the wonderful world of words with you.
That's Not Canon Productions podcast.